Coming up on this morning's programme, we'll be discussing planning for the third age. We'll be joined by an expert panel to discuss how we should care and cater for our ageing population. But first off, just to set the scene as to how Ireland is going to look and change over the next number of years, I'm joined in studio this morning by Conor Keegan of the ESRI. Conor, you're very welcome.
Good morning, Andrea.
Look, research by yourselves at the Economic and Social Research Institute found that our population is going to increase. We're all living a lot longer and we're going to continue to do so. And that all sounds like it's great news. But just first of all, from the research that you carried out, just paint the picture for us.
So Ireland is relatively unique in a European context in terms of the population growth and in terms of the ageing of the population. So, for example, between 1996 and 2016, the Irish population grew by about 31% compared to 6% for the EU on average. We're also ageing much quicker than the European average. So we project that the population aged 65 plus will increase from about 1 in 8 today to 1 in 6 by 2030. The population 85 plus will nearly double. So in terms of the impact that will have for demand for healthcare services, well, we're really going to see an increase right across the board. And our research was a very comprehensive look at all types of healthcare services, you know, across acute, non-acute and public and private services. So, for example, for nursing home residents, we're seeing an increase of between 40 and 54% by 2030. Okay. That's an extra nearly 16,000 residents. For home care packages, for example, we're seeing an increase of up to maybe 66%. But right across the board, we're seeing increases. Again, that's driven by demographics. So, for example, for the hospital sector, for public hospital care, inpatient bed days are projected to increase by maybe 37%. So that, in volume terms, that's an extra 1.2 million bed days.
Okay, and like it's only recently actually in this programme we were talking about the number of people that were going into hospital, being admitted, waiting in trolleys, waiting for beds, you know, delayed discharges, all of these different kind of, I suppose, headlines that people hear about. But you're saying that's even going to increase even further, that level of demand?
That level of demand is going to increase further. And just to point out that our research didn't look at changes in models of care and how we might mitigate some of the demand increases, for example, on the public hospital system.
So these figures you're talking about are as if our services, if our services stay the same, this is what we're going to be facing.
Exactly, okay. Yeah. So there are kind of policy options and policy levers perhaps where we could mitigate some of the increase. Now, mitigate some of the increase means there will still be pressure on acute services because of our demographics and our ageing population, but we might be able to move some of that demand to different sectors. So for example, you mentioned delayed discharges there, which are kind of pejoratively known as bed blockers. So these are individuals who are clinically fit to leave hospital, but for whatever reason, they're still occupying a hospital bed. It might be because there's no home care services available for them. There might be because there's no residential long-term care places. So if we invest perhaps in some of those non-acute services, we might be able to shift some of that demand away from costly hospital services.
Okay, we're going to look at that with our panel actually in just a few moments' time. Can I just ask, Conor, the figures that you mentioned at the very outset, just that share of the population, that age demographic, in terms of kind of the numbers that you project are going to be over 50 and over 60 in the next kind of 10, 15, 20 years' time?
Sure. So I should have said our population projections are based on the 2016 census, so they're the most up-to-date today. So in terms of the population age 65 plus, it currently stands at about 1 in 8 today. That'll increase to about 1 in 6 by 2030.
1 in 6?
1 in 6.
Okay, so that's where the figures are at the moment. Conor Keegan, listen, my thanks to you for joining us in studio today. That's Conor Keegan from the Economic and Social Research Institute.
Thank you.
Well, we've plenty of figures and facts there from the ESRI on the shape and the makeup of Ireland right up until 2030. So to discuss how we should cater and care for our ageing population and what plans we should be putting in place right now, I'm joined in studio by Anne Dempsey of Third Age, Liam Toland, owner of Home Instead Senior Care, and also personal finance expert Frank Conway. You're all very welcome to the studio this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You heard Conor Keegan there at the outset talking about our population, that it's going to increase by nearly a quarter to 2030. The fact that 1 in 6 people are going to be over the age of 60 during that time. And MC of Third Age, what implications do you see that posing for society?
I think, Andrea, what we do in Third Age is we're aware of what's going to happen and we are making kind of provisions in our own way as an NGO for that now, in that our whole focus is to value the contribution of older people. Our name is Third Age, so our aim is to keep people for as long as possible in that third age when they still are productive around transitioning into retirement, post-retirement. We can't change the age people are, but we can change the quality of life people have around that age. And all our programmes are designed to do that.
Liam Toland, you're the owner of Home Instead Senior Care. as you would have heard as well, the figures there that Conor was talking about in terms of kind of that scene setting for how our economy and society is going to look over the course of the next 15, 20 years. How equipped do you think we are to try and accommodate the needs?
Well, I think the first thing that Conor mentioned was we got an awful lot of statistical data. I think what we're missing from the very beginning is the concept that as we age, it's a success.
I think well, that's a good note, and it's a good thing.
We often forget to kind of compliment ourselves that there's so many countries out there that don't get to age, don't get to experience dementia, don't get to experience arthritis, etc. And when you start framing the conversation around costs and bed blockers, it brings immediate negativity towards this wonderful time that people should be enjoying. And I agree 100% with what Anne is saying. We should focus on what we can do.
Yeah.
But already the debate is kicking off in a negative. And I think growing old is not easy. It's not fun. It's hard work. But at the same time, if you're lucky, you get to be old. Mm. And I think that's an important part to say it. Are we well positioned? I think there's good news and less good news. Our first dementia strategy in Ireland came out a few years ago, 90 years into the development of the state. So we're behind in many, many ways. A lot of the figures that are being presented are a little bit frightening. And what I see, certainly on a day-to-day basis, is European strategy, government strategy, all these kind of debates around what we should be doing with these people that happen to be old, which is a negative thing. And sometimes commentators around the housing crisis suggest, well, we should move older people out of their fancy houses and move more deserving people, younger people with young families into those houses. And I think there's some warped logic in it. But again, it's kind of punishing an older person for getting old.
Yeah, we will come to that, because I suppose there's various different ways you can kind of look at that. But the reality is, as Conor pointed out, like, we have more people who are living to be an older age, which, as you mentioned, is a good thing. But I suppose we don't have the resources at the moment to try and accommodate that, to let people and allow people to live to their best and their fullest life. So it's about trying to, you know, find a way to just make life in general better for people. And do we have the resources at the moment to try and accommodate this?
Well, it's a huge challenge to be able to deliver to older adults. Now, again, the challenge for me is even deeper. It's, are we trying to keep vulnerable older adults alive? Are we trying to allow them to live? Are we trying to give them an opportunity to age successfully? And I think we don't have the resources for that ambition. But I think any change in strategy at government level or national level should be centred around the concept that successful ageing has three pillars. The first is high mental and physical functionality. The second is low risk of disease. And for me personally, the most important one is engagement in life. So as we approach the challenge of the growing demographics at this age, I think it's hugely important to, in looking for solutions, to add in not just task-based solutions like hospitals provide and a variety of different places provide, but actually the living bit is something that is certainly missing. Certainly for people, older adults who are living with a cognitive challenge like a dementia.
Frank Conway, your personal finance expert. Justin, we'll get into the financial implications of all of this in a little bit later in the programme. But just in terms of that kind of initial implications that we're going to have to deal with in terms of accommodation, because we're now going to have more older people, and we look at our resources, from a financial perspective, how do you see that panning out?
Really good points made here. So one of the things I often do when I talk to any group that's out there, particularly when I look at retirement, the first thing I'll say to them is what you really want is the quality of life. And you've got to start that by having a lifestyle much earlier on. And I come from a sporting background as well, where I tend to look at things like sugars and the diets and so forth. So because what undermines people's financial security and undermines everything else, their social, has an economic impact, is health conditions. And often health conditions are brought on by lifestyles much earlier on. And that is, you know, I just saw a headline coming in terms of sugars and its contribution to diabetes to dementia in the UK report today. So we see early on that people don't have that approach. And one of the things I tend to look at from a financial perspective is actually a whole of life solution, not just a financial solution. Quality of life, number one, backing it up with the financial security. And in the financial security, there are a whole stream of different mechanisms that can be put in place to ensure that at least they have a reasonable projection of money that they will need at this stage of their lives. And we work towards making sure that people can at least afford to live in comfort, but more importantly, that they get to that stage of their life where they're actually in reasonably good health, And you can take a lot of steps earlier on to making sure that you have that.
Yeah. Look, there's various different options out there in terms of people wanting to stay at home or maybe go into a nursing home, or some people end up in, you know, in medical facilities like hospitals, daycare centres, etc., family members. And some people have a whole host of other complex issues as well, aside from just maybe needing some assistance and some care. In an ideal world, and MC, because you're dealing with people, you know, who are discussing and talking about third age on a regular basis, like, what's the ideal scenario for you in terms of the kind of options that we have out there for people?
Well, all our research and our informal conversations with people would suggest, Andrea, that most people want to live their lives in their own homes for as long and as independently as possible. And a lot of our work is predicated on helping that to come about. And a lot of our programmes are about that. Now, we're a small NGO, they're bottom-up, you know, it's about the living bit, as we're saying here. And I really agree with Frank about, you know, we age, it takes a lifetime to age, so we begin very early. But one of our programmes, which again, I suppose, shows both sides of the coin we're discussing today, is called Senior Line. It's a national telephone listening service for older people. Sounds very modest. In fact, we get over 1,000 calls a month from older people, and the service is delivered by trained older volunteers. So we have these people doing the living bit, you know, training, learning new skills post-retirement, and they're the volunteers. And then we have people at home, and, you know, I would wring your heart at some of the stories we get, you know, about the loneliness. And again, there's no one really to blame for loneliness. It's a complex issue. But one of the things that we do is we help, because people phone us all the time. We're their lifeline. You know, they get up, they phone us. We've somebody who would be living, say, you know, Mick, living in Galway on his own. All he can see is that kind of distant smoke from the chimney. And Mick would get up and phone us, and we're there, and we're his friends. And he'll phone us in the afternoon, he'll phone us in the evening. It's a tiny thing, but it's an important value. And then we've people phoning us with problems and nobody to discuss. So again, there's 1,000 stories from Senior Line. And it's one, you know, very cost-effective, on-the-ground response, which would complement the work of the other gentlemen here. You know, so that's just one of our programmes. Yep. That is one very good response, capable of being scaled up very well.
And I think the idea of loneliness, it goes hand in hand, you know, in many cases as well with third age and with growing older, because as you mentioned, for many people, that's a huge part of it. And it can be a very difficult thing for people to overcome if they're, you know, in a vulnerable stage or at a vulnerable time in their life as well. Is there anything in terms of the kind of resources that you'd like to see implemented, whether it be more funding put into trying to keep people at home, increased, you know, speed or capacity in terms of trying to get the likes of adaptation grants carried out for people and assessments, that kind of thing? Is that something that you think there should be a greater focus on?
I think two things occur to me immediately. That one is that the close down of local facilities, you know, the post office, the banks, the small hospitals, even the pubs. Well, we won't go to the pubs, but just to name it a bit. These are things done in the name of saving costs, and yet they're adding immeasurably to the poverty of rural life, particularly for people who are dependent on rural life. And the other thing that occurs to me, Theresa May did a very imaginative thing last year, and she gets a bad press. She appointed a new minister for loneliness in the UK. And we think it would be well worth discussing a similar situation here. One of the things that happened since she did that, it focused great spotlight on the whole issue of loneliness.
Now, we do have a minister for older people already.
We do. And in fact, Jim Daly, he's excellent. He launched a programme of ours last year. And in fact, I'll make a plug here. He describes Senior Line as an inspirational project. So thank you, Minister. But the Minister for Loneliness, again, someone sitting at the cabinet table, could begin future-proofing, loneliness-proofing a lot of the legislation. So there'd be much more joined-up thinking to prepare for an ageing population. It's very siloed at the minute in many ways.
Okay.
That'll be one to work closely with their Minister of State for Older People.
OK. We heard, Liam, sorry, those figures from Conor earlier on today, talking about the projected increase in our population over 65 and over 85 as well. You're in the business of, I suppose, keeping people at home. That's obviously something that kind of follows on from the point Anne mentioned. I presume that's something you see on a regular basis. People want, where possible, to stay at home where they can and for longer, for as long as they possibly can.
Yeah, and I think part of that journey and couching it in a sense of positivity, over 95% of all over 65s are living at home. So the vast, to back up what Anne is saying, the vast, vast majority of people, like my parents, at home, wake up in their own bed and get on. I think that's a very interesting ambition. And I did a 30,000 word thesis on intergenerational communication. But what I've discovered from the research is that at the core of the challenge that families are meeting is the inability for parents, older adults, to talk to their adult children about their concerns. And more so for the adult children like me in our 40s, just sitting down with my dad or my mom and saying, listen, how are you doing? We're slow to have those conversations.
Why is it just people don't want to face the reality? Well, and we're all in that situation.
We are. It sounds so simple, but it's a Mexican standoff. So what's happening is, like I interviewed people like in their 80s and I say, listen, how did you get on with your son? Oh, fantastic, great. And you talk, oh, we talk about everything. Is there anything taboo? Not at all. Now I'm bringing him on a garden path. Yeah. I said, would you talk about your end of life worries or about the house or all that? Absolutely not. I said, why not? Well, he's 45, he's got three kids, he's married, he's up to his neck in mortgages. I'm not burdening him with my problems. And then I went and discussed that with the son. And the son, oh, I talk about everything. But in reality, what they're actually talking about is
anything and everything.
Is Man United or Irish rugby or Kilkenny hurling.
Yeah.
And the first time something happens is when we get a phone call. And this is why I went and did the thesis, is because mostly daughters ring us. Hard luck there. Yeah. Mostly daughters ring us.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And very quickly, they'll say something like, I'm home from Dublin or Offaly or whatever else. Dad has fallen in the shower. He's had a hip replacement. He's been discharged from Croom. He's going to a step down. And then he's been discharged on Friday. And by the way, I'm going back to Dublin on Monday morning. What do I do now?
Yeah.
And that very person then becomes exceptionally emotional and starts telling us. And one of the things that she'll say is, by the way, if Dad knew I was ringing, He'd kill me.
He'd go mad,
Not kill me. And I was like, so your dad who's reared you in such a loving, caring way and you're giving back now, he's vulnerable. His reaction to you giving love back to him is to kill you. I thought that was fascinating. So the first part of the journey is we're simply not planning. We're not discussing. We're not talking as families about real issues. It's all fine when everyone's relatively healthy. But when mum and dad becomes vulnerable, and we see it all the time, where a dad won't use a walking stick.
Okay.
Because his perception of self has changed. Mm. So we're talking about sport. You know, if I get injured today, I see it as a sports injury. So if a doctor says, Liam, there's a walking stick, there's this, I'll use it to get back to
playing sport. Yeah.
But my dad, who might be in his 80s, will say, no, hang on, that's old age. And that's a very public old age thing. Or if I want to get a banister, which costs like 40 euros, no, don't put that in. If I want to move the bed downstairs, no, don't do that. So at the core of an awful lot of the journey we're on is we're unable as families to discuss a plan or on goals, as in, I want to stay at home. Okay, if you want to stay at home, what do we need to do? That's even before we go near the public health system, before we go near all the
So there's others. Just this is just an example of there's a real communication bubble,
a lack of planning,
as you mentioned, and it's a really difficult conversation that people just aren't having.
And they then have it. I'm sure a lot of the people, and I'm guessing, that ring your helpline are probably discussing stuff that I've just said there, that are struggling with, I don't know what to do, I'm lonely, all these other things. And at the core of it, families themselves, as in everyone in this room, need to start sharing. And I do a lot of talks on this.
Yeah.
And when I, after the talk, an older adult will come up to me, or an adult son or daughter will come up to me and say, Liam, you're spot on. How do I start this conversation? Yeah. How do I start planning? I'm worried.
Because they're probably, I can't imagine, you know, turning around to my parents now, and saying to them today, look, we need to sit down and have a chat and, what's going to happen to you in 20 years' time.
Because
but it's probably
we
something.
We jump into the deep end and we go for the juggler, for want of it. So I would suggest to families, when was the last time you asked your dad advice? Or when was the last time you asked an older adult who might be 75, who has way more ability than I have, for advice, and then thank them for that advice? We tend to, in many cases, marginalise older adults. I'll make the cup of tea, Dad, you're fine. And what we need to do, the word for me is engagement.
Okay.
Engage people.
Frank Conway, just in your own experience in the financial side of things, you spoke earlier today about the kind of conversations you have with people when they're going through these difficult decisions that have to be made. When you look at the kind of options that are out there for people at the moment, we have the home care providing provisions, staying at home, nursing homes. We're now going to have more people that are going to be requiring these kind of services. Mm-hmm. How much of a radical change do you think we need to our entire system to try and accommodate the projected increase in older living that we have?
Absolutely massive. And I think, you know, just the point that came up before, what Liam was making a point in terms of the conversations that don't happen at the family level, you need to have a change between families, kids and so forth. Because one thing in Ireland is that we have amongst the lowest levels of financial literacy in Europe. And one of the things I think drives that lack of conversation sometimes is a lack of understanding of what their rights are, for example. That conversation won't happen. 10 years before my father died, we had that conversation. We decided on how the assets of the family farm and all that and earnings and property would all be divided up. And okay. That was all sorted. And we discovered that there was a title deeds issue. Beyond that, when it comes to finances, I talk to my mother on a regular basis, and actually it's all planned out. So we know exactly what she's going to need and what she wants. And she wants to live at home, by the way. But more broadly, there needs to be an absolute 180-degree flip in terms of actually how money is managed in Ireland. For example, Ireland has one of the most expensive regimes in terms of actually putting money aside. So the big challenge for most people is, will they have enough money to live comfortably at home later? Lifestyle needs to change, absolutely. But most people don't have enough provision put aside for pensions. And I'm not here advocating for pensions, by the way. I'm advocating for pensions reform, which is absolutely huge, which does not come into the narrative. And this is where you build some family wealth much quicker than what has happened to now. Because what's happened to now is most people may have a DB scheme at work, a defined benefit scheme. They come out of that. Those are being ripped up, torn up, thrown out. And we're finding now that people are being actually challenged to understand complex financial arrangements, which they don't understand. How do you plan for living 30 years or 20 years beyond the working life? If you've worked till 70 maybe, and you live for another 20 or 30 years, how do you pay for that? And that's a major issue. That
the other point just on that as well, and we were only talking about it actually last week, is that because people are, like in my age, are buying houses, their first house at a later stage in their life, they now have a longer mortgage they have to pay off. And that's possibly eating into the amount or when they're starting their pension as well.
That's a real challenge. So one of the things I find at a very young age is that the language that is often used by pensions advisor puts people off, because you go into a company and it's a bit like warfare. They talk about an OPS, they talk about DB, DC, and suddenly they've lost you. What I try to do to anybody in their 20s, we bring out the actuarial calculators, we show them how money grows, and then we show them all the variables that go into that. A big movement globally right now, it's in Holland, it's in the UK, it's in the US, it's actually how much are management teams taking for managing money. And I work out some very simple mathematics. I will take somebody at age 25, who put their money
aside. And it's really frightening when you do this as well, because a lot of people get affrighted what they need to be putting aside to try and cater for themselves in 40 years' time.
It's not a lot of money. If you take somebody at 25 and puts 5,000 euro aside every year, and they might get a match from the company on that, but they will get tax relief on that, and then you invest the right way, you invest what we call very low passive, they will end up with probably an extra 100,000 just by simply adjusting how that money's managed.
But what about even for anyone listening today who's like myself in their early 30s and, you know, they're kind of thinking, well, I've only started a pension or I haven't started a pension because I'm not even thinking about third age at the moment, but I might have parents who are entering that category in the next 10 or 15 years, and how am I going to fund this? Like, these are kind of, I think, you know, real life conversations that a lot of us in our 30s aren't having. Like,
and you're not having them because I think often the industry itself puts people off. The industry is almost constructed in the old days. When Bismarck first brought out pensions in Germany in the late 1800s, you know, his advisor said, we're going to pay people in retirement. Bismarck said, I don't really like that idea. Most people only live to age 45 when they got the pensions at age 65. That has all flipped. We've talked about in terms of the demographic changes and so forth. For anybody in their 30s, they get this right away. Mm-hmm. So the big challenge for most people today in Dublin is, how do I buy a home, for example? That's one of the pillars.
Yeah, but that's it. The pension, you know, the pension in third age is so far down the list at this stage for, I think, a lot of people of my age. You know, it's not something that we think about. But
yeah, and you don't. But actually, when we go through the mathematics with them, and it is very simple maths, when we show them the mathematics, they get it. They see it. They understand it. But what we don't do for younger people, where you need to begin to get involved from a health perspective, from a financial perspective, is it is not explained simply to them. I did a seminar a couple of weeks ago within a company, went through the maths, and they all get it. Okay. They understand it because we use what we call actuarial calculators. We work out how much you're going to need, and it's quite simple. Mm. It is the language and it is the charging structures which puts most people off.
Okay. I want to just bring you in as well, Anne Dempsey, just on a couple of the points that Liam Tolan mentioned before the break, that idea of, you know, the difficulties people have when they enter that kind of vulnerable stage and they might have had a fall, they've just come out of hospital and now they require a walking stick. Maybe they need to sit down and have a chat with their son or daughter about the fact that they might need a little bit of assistance in the morning or in the afternoon, or maybe they've actually realised that I need some full-time help here, I can't do this on my own. How difficult is that for people that you deal with on a daily basis to try and accept and to try and have those conversations?
I think it's very difficult. I think, and there's a lot of reasons for it. I think we're a funny kind of a nation, we Irish, as you say. A lot of men phone us and they're lonely, and they but all they want to talk about is the match,
right,
or give out about Bertie Ahern. You know, they will never talk about what's really closer to their heart. Now, women will phone and say, I'd row with my sister yesterday and I'm devastated.
Okay, you know, so you get all the details.
There's a gender piece there. And the other thing is that I think we are an ageist society. And I think the people that imbibe it most fully frequently are older people themselves. That older people don't like the fact that they're growing older. You know, the not using the walking stick is how you're perceived, not having that conversation. And I think Liam is right that a lot of older people feel their sons and their daughters are up to their neck in negative equity, and they don't want to annoy or burden them. I suppose what we would feel in third age is, in looking for a hugely older population, that we're very interested. There's going to be numbers, never mind the statistics. How about the quality of life of these people?
Okay.
We all know that we're adding huge years to the life, but what kind of life are we adding to the years? And that's what we're all about. And we've been talking about physical health. I think what's hugely important, and financial health is desperately important. I mean, you need enough to live on, you know, your whole, what's our friend, the hierarchy of needs.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like you need the Maslow, our friend. You need the basics. But after that, the whole area of feeling you matter, feeling there's somebody you need to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
We have one of our programs at the moment is it's combining 21st century technology with old fashioned face to face friendliness. It's called Aged Well.
Yeah.
And we're training people to go in, older people again, it's a peer service, to go in and get to know an older person living on their own. Now the older person signs up to this. It's in its infancy, but it could be scaled up really well. Very intelligent kind of program. And we're training our older companions in the use of an app. And they go in with their app, they get to know the person, and in about 1 minute questions are answered easily on the app. And then they're fed into our database. And if there's any intervention needed, so it's early warning, it's health promotion,
okay,
it's giving the person something. That's a small little project, which is terribly intelligent with a lot to offer.
Just if I can bring you in, Liam Toland, one of the figures I thought was quite interesting that Conor Keegan from the ESRI mentioned earlier in the programme, the fact that demand for nursing homes is going to increase by about 54%. So we're talking about nearly over 15,500 extra places. And also the demand for home help hours, that's actually projected to increase by about 54% in the next kind of 15, 16 years. When you're like, I know you obviously are in the business of trying to keep people at home and providing that home care service for people. Do you think we're going to have to have an awful lot more government intervention and statutory intervention from the government to try and create that sort of help and support to allow that to happen, as opposed to having to you know, create more nursing home provisions to let people go into nursing homes?
Well, I think at the core of all this is choice. So clearly, I think the four of us indeed, yourself, would agree that the goal for everybody, regardless of age, is to stay at home. The good news is 95% of those over 65 are. But the 4%, the 5% is going to grow in terms of the amount of people. And I think as they become more vulnerable, I think if choice was a key part of it now, so what does the person who is 75 or 85 want to do? And some will have their financial ability to make that choice, but many don't. Many haven't started at 25.
Yeah.
And many, so we need to approach who is in this bubble now, today, not in 40, 50 years' time. So choice is hugely important. But at the core of the choice is, are we trying to allow people to age successfully, keep them alive? are we allowing them to remain engaged in life? And the greatest negative to successful aging is not that you can't do something, mm-hmm. is that you don't have the opportunity.
Yeah.
So whatever people's choice should be, it should be tailored with the opportunity to stay engaged. And that means that if there are more nursing home beds, which provide a hugely important service to mm-hmm. our state, many of which are public, many of which are private, hugely important, because many people would not exist without the ability to go in. And even a step down, I think there's an opportunity for much more step down.
Yeah, yeah.
There's an opportunity for development of villages, safe environments where people stay in their own community. But choice is hugely important. So if we do invest more money, it shouldn't be to keep people alive, and it shouldn't be to do tasks for older adults who can't. It should be allow that older adult to have a dignified, engaged life, which allows them to continue to age as successfully as possible. So huge investment is required.
Yeah.
There's certainly look at now I'm not a health economist, but there's the amount of money being invested in hospitals a week, in a hospital 6,000-7,000. What can be achieved with that money at home,
keeping people
in some
at home.
Shape or form? And I think that's it, particularly when you layer in on top of it a cognitive challenge. You have to be conscious that it isn't simply give the person medication in the morning and expect them to be okay tomorrow. They need socialisation, they need encouragement.
Can I just ask you, we have the likes of the statutory schemes like Fair Deal Scheme, etc., for the likes of nurse and home care. We don't have that though for home care.
No, we don't. But to be
how
fair,
how much of a difference would that make, do you think?
It would be huge, obviously, okay. because it would allow again choice, but it would give that older adult a legal position in their ability to stay at home as well. So, but my understanding from a HSE point of view is that they're quite close to getting that across the line, which should be very, very significant.
Okay. Can I just bring you in, Frank Conway, as well? The idea of a radical approach, and Liam Tolan touched on it there as well, this idea of more kind of retirement homes and retirement villages. We have some of them in the private sector, and we actually have more cropping up as well in the public arena as well. How beneficial do you think they are? And even just from a cost analysis perspective, as well?
Yeah, I tend to look at the US market, which is much more advanced in this area, and the cost of that has been absolutely huge. The challenge has always been, and we are coming into these problems here, we're beginning to face a lot of these difficulties, but the challenges are broadly, have they worked out in terms of what those costs will be, for example, or will there be extra costs for an individual or a family, for example, if an issue arises or health issue arises? So what I've often seen in the US, and you know, and that was part of my background, was in terms of what type of products were sold to these families. Are they still sustainable? There's been a huge number of reports in the last couple of weeks. So the big challenge will be, it always comes back to the cost itself. And have we worked that cost out? And do we know how long people would live? For example, you've got the state, the home choice, or the other one, which is the take the equity out of the property, which is for the state, for example.
Okay, yeah.
Do we know how much that's going to cost the family, for example? Do we know how much it's going to cost for private development, for example, for senior care villages, for example? We actually don't. And that's become a huge issue internationally in terms of some of the programs that were developed to fund those have gone bankrupt, for example, or premiums have doubled and tripled and quadrupled. So the big challenge ultimately is long-term planning for this.
Okay.
And this perhaps for that 80 age group, which is going to double over the next number of years, perhaps for them the challenge will the state have an intervention here or not? But for long-term, for the likes of myself or for the likes of people in their 30s, for example, the challenge will be, how have you thought about this long-term? And the maths are very difficult, you know. So we do a lot of work in terms of actually some of the actuarial numbers in terms of what's going to be needed. And what we're finding internationally is that, you know, that living longer, the improvements in healthcare, for example, means that it's creating a huge, bigger challenge for the entire system. So I think that probably needs to start right away. It needs to start very quickly. And we need to start in terms of looking in terms of actually what it's really going to cost. And we don't know, but it will cost huge resources.
If I can just, Anne, come to yourself. We were talking about a radical approach and a long-term plan just before the last break. And this day, 3 weeks ago, the Sunday Independent featured a story about these new state-funded, elderly-friendly retirement villages that were going to be state-funded. It would be a very radical approach. Just in your experience from talking to people, do you think, I suppose, older people would like to go into the likes of these kind of friendly retirement villages where it's sort of a one-stop shop?
Yeah, I've a qualified yes to it, but I'd love to talk about a different radical, if I may, Andrea. And, you know, in the year 1900, older people were 1 in 25. And your guest this morning said we're going to be 1 in 6. So we all know the whole situation. Older people, lots and lots of them. And so I think we need to be very radical that this is a reality. So we need to prepare by training, beginning as young, much younger people, as children, to learn to be much more resilient, our mental health to be much better, to learn to think for ourselves. You know, they talk about the snowflake generation mm-hmm. now, that, you know, so a whole contra to that. We have people, we all know in this room people who are older, who are self-sufficient, who are self-nurturing. Now, there's a question of luck here. You know, you could fall tomorrow and it all could go to the mm-hmm. wind. But there's a lot of different kinds of preparation to do with for living an older life in a way that's engaging, that's manageable, that, dare I say it, happy.
Okay, so you think we need effectively a very different radical long-term plan to try and, I suppose, accommodate these projections?
Absolutely.
Okay, Frank Conway, co-founder of MoneyWiz and your personal finance expert as well. What do you think in terms of our long-term planning requirements?
Absolutely agree with Anne. I think it's education. I think at a very early stage when it comes to physical well-being, we need a whole education process around that in terms of actually, you know, showing people what actually happens, the headlines, for example, the sugars and the diets, the impact that has on. But also around financial education, we simply just don't have it. We don't educate people enough in terms of long-term planning. And the conversation we're having earlier is that people in their 20s and 30s don't want to talk about what we call pensions. I call it long-term post-employment savings plans, for example. Mm. They are the best value.
Yeah, I wish somebody had this conversation with me actually 10 years ago. I think I was missing that day.
you have plenty of time, but people don't understand the impact that time has. Plenty of time in order for money to grow. This is a huge part. There are 6 pillars to understanding money. We need to teach all of them from a very early age, from age 7. Kids from age 7 begin to form money habits for life.
In terms of like concerns that people might have, maybe as they're kind of entering third age or older people, about the idea of, I suppose, financial fraud, is that something that's
huge,
a concern?
Huge. And this is a program we're working on at the moment. It's actually called Preventing Fraud and Financial Exploitation in Retirement. Now, here's something that's really interesting. I thought that this would have been something that people in their retirement, I did a survey last year, I broke it out for people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s and 60s. And I thought the interest in that would have been for people in their 60s. People in their 20s and 30s were particularly interested, and I think they were interested because they are concerned about loved ones, they're concerned about family, and they're also concerned about themselves. But it has an immediate impact. And often fraud can happen within the family or from external parties as well. This is also a huge part of the program to aging well. And I think we need to have that education program on top of building the wealth and protecting the health, the physical health as well.
And Dempsey, can I just bring you on those points, in on those points that Frank Conway mentioned there? Yeah. Is that a concern for your members?
Very much so. We get people who are suffering from elder abuse and a lot of financial elder abuse, the fraud thing. Now, there can be physical, mental, emotional. And we have the contact for the HSE is a very, very good program to respond to elder abuse. They've dedicated officers and we have all their names and contact details. So it's a real, real issue. And frequently you've nobody to tell. And frequently we're the first people, because the phone is a nice, anonymous, safe way of telling something that is almost untellable. And we believe them. And if we start then a new conversation about how you can help yourself, anyone you can turn to, a real growing issue.
Okay. Liam Toland, I'll give you the final word this morning. In terms of our long-term plan that we're going to need and a kind of a new radical approach to dealing with these really, really sharp increases in projections for the number of older people we're going to have in the next 15 years. What do you think is going to be required?
Well, I think, again, I'm not a health economist, but I think a massive shift from the hospital scene out to primary care. Like, we work with public health nurses every day. Phenomenal group of people delivering a wonderful, wonderful service. The more support that they get, the more physiotherapists, the more occupational therapists, the more that we can keep older adults in their homes, the longer. We know anecdotally and by research that when you have a vulnerable older adult that is linked into the primary care, be it home care that we would deliver or be it the public health nurse, scenarios are being spotted way quicker, way earlier, and you're preventing people going into the hospitals in the first place. And the quicker you can then move, because we know for every week, if I go into hospital, I'm relatively fit and strong. If I am in hospital for a couple of weeks, it won't erode my abilities too much. But my dad, an extra week could have a monumental negative effect on his abilities. That's the first thing. The second thing is, it's the simplest thing I'd like to get across today, is planning. get talking. If you happen to be 30 or 40 or 50 and you have a parent who's 70, 80, 90, you need to start the conversations now. And we always give credit to the older adult. You know, the guy who lives down the road, who's driving his car at 96 and he's worthy, and you say, wow, isn't he fantastic? I say, what happens tomorrow when he can't drive that car? Because that man's life will change forever. We should complement the successful aging that we're actually all part of, but we should be conscious that at some point in time, somebody will get, and Anne mentioned their elder abuse. For me, the greatest elder abuse is neglect. And fundamentally, we are people. So we can invent as many machines and apps and things as we like, but ultimately, we want our older adults engaging with people, be it in the local parish, the local whatever, whatever else. And we need plans around that, not just tasks, but actually engaging in life.
Okay, so it's the advice to people this morning is maybe not this morning, but certainly in
Launch into the 5-star question.
Yeah.
But start building and by the way, for those who are 40 and they've got kids, start an appropriate conversation now that when they get to 50 and 60 and 70, that they're already streamlining their children into what they want to be as a goal. So by the time I get to 80, that my kids, the old joke is, I'm not going into a nursing home, you know. But actually, why not say, convert that and say, my goal, by the way, guys, is to stay at home. So for me to achieve that, I'm changing the bathroom, I'm putting an extra banister on, I'm moving the bed downstairs
or,
and be proud of the fact that your goal is to stay at home. So what do you need to do in terms of your planning to make that happen?
Okay, well, look, with plenty to consider there this morning, folks, and my thanks to you for joining us in studio, Anne Dempsey of Third Age, Liam Toland, who's the owner of Home Instead Senior Care, and also the co-founder of MoneyWiz and personal finance expert Frank Conway. My thanks to our production team today, Stephen Jordan and Aidan McKelvey, and Marianne Kennedy on sound. I'll be back next Sunday from 8 o'clock, but for me, Andrea Gilligan, have a great day.
Between the Lines on News Talk.